Chapter 23 is accomplished in a very few minutes. Then all sit down, and you have a solid mass of 1,500 heads, making a steep cellar door slant from the rear of the house down to the stage. All the lights were turned low, so low that the congregation sat in a deep and solemn gloom. The funereal rustling of dresses and the low buzz of conversation began to die swiftly down, and presently not the ghost of a sound was left. This profound and increasingly impressive stillness endured for some time, the best preparation for music, spectacle, or speech conceivable. I should think our show people would have invented or imported that simple and impressive device for securing and solidifying the attention of an audience long ago, instead of which there continue to this day to open a performance against a deadly competition in the form of noise, confusion, and a scattered interest. Finally, out of darkness and distance and mystery, soft rich notes rose upon the stillness, and from his grave the dead magician began to weave his spells about his disciples, and steep their souls in his enchantments. There was something strangely impressive in the fancy which kept intruding itself, that the composer was conscious in his grave of what was going on here, and that these divine souls were the clothing of thoughts which were at this moment passing through his brain, and not recognized, unfamiliar ones which had issued from it at some former time. The entire overture, long as it was played to a dark house with the curtain down. It was exquisite. It was delicious. But straightway thereafter, or course, came the singing, and it does seem to me that nothing can make a Wagner opera absolutely perfect and satisfactory to the untutored, but to leave out the vocal parts. I wish I could see a Wagner opera done in pantomime once. Then one would have the lovely orchestration unvexed to listen to, and bathe his spirit in, and the bewildering beautiful scenery to intoxicate his eyes with, and the dumb acting couldn't mar these pleasures, because there isn't often anything in the Wagner opera that one would call by such a violent name as acting. As a rule, all you would see would be a couple of silent people, one of them standing still, the other catching flies. Of course, I do not really mean that he would be catching flies. I only mean that the usual operatic gestures which consist in reaching first one hand out into the air, and then the other, might suggest the sport I speak of, if the operator attended strictly to business and uttered no sound. This present opera was arciful. Madame Wagner does not permit its representation anywhere but in Bayreuth. The first act of the three occupied 2 hours, and I enjoyed that in spite of the singing. I trust that I know as well as anybody that singing is one of the most entrancing and bewitching and moving and eloquent of all the vehicles invented by man for the conveying of feeling. But it seems to me that the chief virtue in song is melody, air, tune, rhythm, or what you please to call it, and that when this feature is absent, what remains is a picture with the color left out. I was not able to detect in the vocal parts of Arcifal anything that might with confidence be called rhythm or tune or melody. One person performed at a time and a long time, too often in a noble, and always in a high-toned, voice. But he only pulled out long notes, then some short ones, then another long one, then a sharp, quick, peremptory bark or two, and so on and so on. And when he was done, you saw that the information which he had conveyed had not compensated for the disturbance. Not always, but pretty often. If two of them would but put in a duet occasionally and blend the voices, but no, they don't do that. The great master, who knew so well how to make 100 instruments rejoice in unison and pour out their souls in mingled and melodious tides of delicious sound, deals only in barren solos when he puts in the vocal parts. It may be that he was deep and only added the singing to his operas for the sake of the contrast it would make with the music. Singing. It does seem the wrong name to apply to it. Strictly described, it is a practicing of difficult and unpleasant intervals, mainly. An ignorant person gets tired of listening to gymnastic intervals, in the long run, no matter how pleasant they may be. In Arsifal there is a hermit named Gurnemans who stands on the stage in one spot and practices by the hour, while first one, and then another character of the cast endures what he can of it, and then retires to die. During the evening there was an intermission of 3/4 hour after the first act and 1 hour long after the second. In both instances the theater was totally emptied. People who had previously engaged tables in the one sole eating house were able to put in their time very satisfactorily. The other 1,000 went hungry. The opera was concluded at 10 in the evening or a little later. When we reached home we had been gone more than 7 hours. 7 hours at $5 a ticket is almost too much for the money. While browsing about the front yard among the crowd between the acts I encountered 12 or 15 friends from different parts of America, and those of them who were most familiar with Wagner said that Arsifal seldom pleased at first, but that after one had heard it several times it was almost sure to become a favorite. It seemed impossible, but it was true, for the statement came from people whose word was not to be doubted. And I gathered some further information. On the ground I found part of a German musical magazine, and in it a letter written by Ulick 33 years ago, in which he defends the scorned and abused Wagner against people like me, who found fault with the comprehensive absence of what our kind regards as singing. Ulick says Wagner despised in Plapperud music, and therefore uns, trills, and schnorkel are discarded by him. I don't know what a schnorkel is, but now that I know it has been left out of these operas I never have missed so much in my life. And Ulick further says that Wagner's song is true. That it is simply emphasized in toned speech. That certainly describes it in Arsifal and some of the operas. And if I understand Ulick's elaborate German he apologizes for the beautiful airs in Tannhäuser. Very well. Now that Wagner and I understand each other, perhaps we shall get along better, and I shall stop calling Wagner on the American plan, and thereafter call him Wagner, as per German custom, for I feel entirely friendly now. The minute we get reconciled to a person, how willing we are to throw aside little needless punctilios and pronounce his name right. Of course I came home wondering why people should come from all corners of America to hear these operas, when we have lately had a season or two of them in New York with these same singers in the several parts, and possibly the same orchestra. I resolved to think that out at all hazards. Tuesday. Yesterday they played the only operatic favorite I have ever had, an opera which has always driven me mad with ignorant delight, whenever I have heard it, Tannhäuser. I heard it first, when I was a youth. I heard it last in the last German season in New York. I was busy yesterday and I did not intend to go, knowing I should have another Tannhäuser opportunity in a few days. But after 5 o'clock I found myself free and walked out to the opera house, and arrived about the beginning of the second act. My opera ticket admitted me to the grounds in front, past the policeman and the chain, and I thought I would take a rest on a bench for 1 hour and 2 and wait for the third act. In a moment or so the first bugles blew, and the multitude began to crumble apart and melt into the theater. I will explain that this bugle call is one of the pretty features here. You see, the theater is empty, and hundreds of the audience are a good way off in the feeding house. The first bugle call is blown about 1/4 hour before time for the curtain to rise. This company of buglers, in uniform, march out with military step, and send out over the landscape a few bars of the theme of the approaching act, piercing the distances with the gracious notes. Then they march to the other entrance and repeat. Presently they do this over again. Yesterday only about 200 people were still left in front of the house when the second call was blown. In another half minute they would have been in the house, but then a thing happened which delayed them, the only solitary thing in this world which could be relied on with certainty to accomplish it. I suppose an imperial princess appeared in the balcony above them. They stopped dead in their tracks and began to gaze in a stupor of gratitude and satisfaction. The lady presently saw that she must disappear, or the doors would be closed upon these worshippers, so she returned to her box. This daughter-in-law of an emperor was pretty, as he had a kind face. She was without airs. She is known to be full of common human sympathies. There are many kinds of princesses, but this kind is the most harmful of all, for wherever they go they reconcile people to monarchy, and set back the clock of progress. The valuable princes, the desirable princes, are the czars and their sort. By their mere dumb presence in the world they cover with derision every argument that can be invented in favor of royalty by the most ingenious casuist. In his time the husband of this princess was valuable. He led a degraded life, he ended it with his own hand in circumstances and surroundings of a hideous sort, and was buried like a god. In the opera house there is a long loft back of the audience, a kind of open gallery in which princes are displayed. It is sacred to them, it is the holy of holies. As soon as the filling of the house is about complete, the standing multitude turn and fix their eyes upon the princely layout and gaze mutely and longingly and adoringly and regretfully like sinners looking into heaven. They become rapt, unconscious, steeped in worship. There is no spectacle anywhere that is more pathetic than this. It is worth crossing many oceans to see. It is somehow not the same gaze that people rivet upon a Victor Hugo, or Niagara, or the bones of the mastodon, or the guillotine of the Revolution, or the Great Pyramid, or distant Vesuvius smoking in the sky, or any man long celebrated to you by his genius and achievements, or thing long celebrated to you by the praises of books and pictures. No, that gaze is only the gaze of intense curiosity, interest, wonder, engaged in drinking delicious deep draughts that taste good all the way down, and appease and satisfy the thirst of a lifetime. Satisfy it, that is the word. Hugo and the mastodon will still have a degree of intense interest thereafter when encountered, but never anything approaching the ecstasy of that first view. The interest of a prince is different. It may be envy, it may be worship, doubtless it is a mixture of both, and it does not satisfy its thirst with one view, or even noticeably diminish it. Perhaps the essence of the thing is the value which men attach to a valuable something which has come by luck and not been earned. A dollar picked up in the road is more satisfaction to you than the 99 which you had to work for, and money won at fair or in stocks snuggles into your heart in the same way. A prince picks up grandeur, power, and a permanent holiday and gratis support by a pure accident, the accident of birth, and he stands always before the grieved eye of poverty and obscurity a monumental representative of luck. And then, supremest value of all is the only high fortune on the earth which is secure. The commercial millionaire may become a beggar, the illustrious statesman can make a vital mistake and be dropped and forgotten. The illustrious general can lose a decisive battle, and with it the consideration of men. But once a prince, always a prince, that is to say, an imitation god, and neither art, fortune, nor an infamous character, nor an addled brain, nor the speech of an ass can undeify him. By common consent of all the nations, and all the ages, the most valuable thing in this world is the homage of men, whether deserved or undeserved. It follows without doubt or question, then, that the most desirable position possible is that of a prince. And I think it also follows that the so-called usurpations with which history is littered are the most excusable misdemeanors which men have committed. To usurp a usurpation, that is all it amounts to, isn't it? A prince is not to us what he is to a European, of course. We have not been taught to regard him as a god, and so one good look at him is likely to so nearly appease our curiosity as to make him an object of no greater interest the next time. We want a fresh one. But it is not so with the European. I am quite sure of it. The same old one will answer. He never stales. 18 years ago I was in London and I called at an Englishman's house on a bleak and foggy and dismal December afternoon, to visit his wife and married daughter by appointment. I waited half an hour, and then they arrived, frozen. They explained that they had been delayed by an unlooked-for circumstance. While passing in the neighborhood of Marlborough House, they saw a crowd gathering, and were told that the Prince of Wales was about to drive out, so they stopped to get a sight of him. They had waited half an hour on the sidewalk, freezing with the crowd, but were disappointed at last the Prince had changed his mind. I said, with a good deal of surprise, "Is it possible that you two have lived in London all your lives, and have never seen the Prince of Wales?" Apparently it was their turn to be surprised, for they exclaimed, "Had an idea! Why, we have seen him hundreds of times." They had seen him hundreds of times, yet they had waited half an hour in the gloom and the bitter cold, in the midst of a jam of patients from the same asylum, on the chance of seeing him again. It was a stupefying statement, but one is obliged to believe the English, even when they say a thing like that. I fumbled around for a remark, and got out this one. "I can't understand it at all. If I had never seen General Grant, I doubt if I would do that even to get a sight of him." With a slight emphasis on the last word. Their blank faces showed that they wondered where the parallel came in. Then they said, blankly, "Of course not. He is only a president. It is doubtless a fact that a prince is a permanent interest, an interest not subject to deterioration. The general who was never defeated, the general who never held a council of war, the only general who ever commanded a connected battle front 1,200 miles long, the smith who welded together the broken parts of a great republic and re-established it, where it is quite likely to outlast all the monarchies present and to come, was really a person of no serious consequence to these people. To them, with their training, my general was only a man after all, while their prince was clearly much more than that, a being of a wholly unsimilar construction and constitution, and being of no more blood and kinship with men than are the serene eternal lights of the firmament with the poor dull tallow candles of commerce that sputter and die and leave nothing behind but a pinch of ashes and a stink. I saw the last act of Anne Coleman Osser. I sat in the gloom and the deep stillness, waiting 1 minute, 2 minutes, I do not know exactly how long. Then the soft music of the hidden orchestra began to breathe its rich, long sighs out from under the distant stage, and by the drop curtain parted in the middle, and was drawn softly aside, disclosing the twilighted wood and a wayside shrine, with a white-robed girl praying, and a man standing near. Presently that noble chorus of men's voices was heard approaching, and from that moment until the closing of the curtain it was music, just music, music to make one drunk with pleasure, music to make one take scrip and staff, and beg his way round the globe to hear it. To such as are intending to come here in the Wagner season next year, I wish to say, bring your dinner pail with you. If you do, you will never cease to be thankful. If you do not, you will find it a hard fight to save yourself from famishing in Bereth. Bereth is merely a large village, and has no very large hotels or eating houses. The principal inns are the Golden Anchor and the Sun. At either of these places you can get an excellent meal. No, I mean you can go there and see other people get it. There is no charge for this. The town is littered with restaurants, but they are small and bad, and they are overdriven with custom. You must secure a table hours beforehand, and often when you arrive you will find somebody occupying it. We have had Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.